sister. We're two of a kind, so sister, I'm keeping my eyes on you. I bet you think I don't know nothing but singing the blues. Oh, sister, have I got news for you? I'm something. I hope you think that you're something.
Greetings, WBAI listeners. Welcome to Women, Body, and Soul, dialogues on women's health, relationships, and sexuality with holistic multicultural perspectives. This is 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio, New York City. I'm your host, Natalie Tandiway. In today's show, we'll discuss female double consciousness and the rise of self-objectification among women in U.S. culture. Our guest, Professor Carolyn Heldman, Ph.D., is author of the article on self-objectification, Out of Body Image, in the latest edition of Ms. Magazine. Dr. Heldman earned her Ph.D. in political science from Rutgers University and is currently an assistant professor at Occidental College in Los Angeles. She's published in the top journals in her field and co-authored Rethinking Madam President, Are We Ready for a Woman in the White House? She specializes in the presidency, media, gender, and race in the American context. Prior to teaching at Occidental, Professor Heldman taught at Whittier College, Fairfield University, and Rutgers. She's also been active in politics as a congressional staffer, campaign manager, campaign consultant, and political activist. She drove to New Orleans to help with the rebuilding efforts the week Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast and has returned to the city numerous times to assist in rebuilding. She's also director of volunteer recruitment at the New Orleans Women's Shelter, founded post-Katrina to provide transitional housing for women and children in the New Orleans area and assist them in establishing independence. Dr. Heldman is the co-founder of Critical Response, a group that provides volunteers to engage in high-risk rescue efforts during crises and disasters. She has worked as a political reviewer for the Associated Press and a reporter for KPFK Los Angeles. Dr. Heldman's work has been featured in the New York Times and U.S. News and World Report. Welcome, Dr. Heldman.
Thank you.
It's an honor to have you with us. Your bio is really inspiring that you've combined both academia and community-based activism. It's very rare and very admirable.
Well, thank you. I don't see how one could live solely in the academy. That would be a dull life.
Okay. You know, I did read your article in Miss Out of Body Image, and, you know, it's interesting. I think that, in general, the observation that women are objectified in the media and also in real-life interactions, it's not a new analysis or a new conversation, but your observation and analysis regarding the rising levels of what we call self-objectification among girls and women and your growing body of work around this is adding a lot of synergy, I think, to the intersection of media and gender studies. One of the things I find interesting is your appropriation of the E.B. Du Bois's term double consciousness to describe the female experience of self-objectification. Let's step back a little bit. You know, what do you mean by double consciousness in this context?
Well, double consciousness in the sense that little girls are raised and then grow into women who view themselves not from an inside-out perspective, but rather are constantly viewing themselves from the outside in and wondering how the world views them, and that actually becomes their own consciousness. So instead of it being an internal organic thing, it's constant habitual body monitoring and concern about how the outside world views one. So in that sense, your identity is somewhat removed and inauthentic in some fundamental ways.
And when was this shift in the discourse within gender studies from talking about female objectification to this idea of self-objectification?
That's a great question. And you're right, this is an old topic and an old debate. However, self-objectification is the product of objectification. Mm-hmm. So in the 1970s, we were talking a lot about women's bodies and objectification and how that translates in terms of power dynamics. And more recently, we're looking at the internal effects of that. So that's the new piece. And it's really come to the fore in the past maybe 15 years, mm-hmm. as the sexualization of little girls has taken hold. The American Psychological Association has now done a decade-long study, and they found that this is a relatively new phenomenon. It's new in the sense that we now have normalized it, right? We accept the sexualization of little girls. And I'm not to play the blame game, because I don't really think the artists are responsible when they're children, but we saw the emergence of Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears and other highly sexualized, not only child performers, but appealing to children. Mm-hmm. And that is new, and that has caused rates of self-objectification to shoot through the roof.
I'm curious about the APA report you referred to. What was the scope of the study? How was the study done, and what were the findings?
Well, it was a qualitative meta-analysis, if you will, to use some technical terms. Mm-hmm. It simply looked at all of the studies that had come out on this subject in the past 10 years, and they found that the effects are very negative, and not in a prudish sort of way, right? I think a lot of feminist academics in particular are worried about being perceived as anti-sex and in analyzing this. But I actually think it's very pro-sex, because one of the negative side effects of having, you know, women's objectification and little girls' objectification really being a normal part of everyday American life now is that we start to eroticize being attractive for men, or we eroticize male pleasure in new ways. And we're moving further, I would argue, moving further away from an organic female sexuality or sexualities. So I actually see this work as being very liberating in terms of both recognizing that our sexuality has been hijacked, basically, our sexual imagination and what we eroticize, and really opening spaces to think about, well, what would sexualization look like if we didn't eroticize male pleasure?
I've read more of your work other than just the article in Ms., and I found the results interesting regarding how self-objectification impacts girls and women. And you talk about higher rates of depression, low self-esteem, low faith in themselves, diminished political efficacy, even lowered cognitive function in another study. And increased risk of eating disorders, and interestingly, also impaired motor skills. Can you comment, on these effects? Because I think that when we talk about theories and ideas like objectification and self-objectification, it seems very academic, and it seems very distant, and it seems almost like a critique, and it becomes disconnected from real life and real people.
Mm-hmm.
Can you draw a picture for the listener of how this impacts us, the girls and women in our lives?
Sure. And you bring up a very good point that even using a term like self-objectification doesn't really capture the experience. And what's so perhaps ironic about it is it's an experience that women get, girls understand.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we start to talk about it, it becomes clear that we are all experiencing something rather similar. And in terms of the ways in which it translates into everyday life, so the basic thing is that, you know, little boys are raised to view their bodies as tools to master their environment.
Mm-hmm.
And little girls are raised to view their bodies as projects to be worked on. And that ultimately leads to radically different orientations in the world. So whereas men, you know, boys grown to men who use their bodies to really take charge of their environment and view their bodies in that sense, women are girls who grow into women are raised with the orientation that we're here to please. And that's kind of a fundamental part of our identity and the way in which women are defined in American culture. So how does this manifest? Well, it manifests itself in ways such as habitual body monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we are constantly thinking about how we look to the outside world. We spend a lot of cognitive time. We spend a lot of time in front of the mirror getting ready, some more or less. You know, some women are higher self-objectifiers than others, but we're on that spectrum. Some researchers out of Ann Arbor estimated that over the course of a woman's lifetime, she will spend the amount of time it would take to get 3 PhDs simply thinking about her body and how it appears to the outside world.
I thought you were going to say looking in the mirror.
Right, well, that's a part of it. That's a part of it. All this time we invest, right, thinking about that. And it also affects us in terms of that lower cognitive functioning, I think, is a great kind of study to talk about. The researchers who have done the study and then replicated it brought in women with similar test scores and men with similar test scores and aptitude for for math. And they put them in different experimental settings. In one setting, it's all women and they're normally clothed. In another, it's all women and they're in swimsuits. And then it's a co-ed. The third is a co-ed setting where the women and men are in swimsuits. And the scores for women drop dramatically as not only they move into the swimsuit, but they move around men. They get into a co-ed setting. So we know that women are, when we are concerned about our bodies, that saps our cognitive energy. And of course, we're also, when you're constantly thinking about how you look and you're worried about that, and that's really the way in which you define yourself, you're gonna have lower self-esteem. This is going to lead to, eating disorders. It's going to lead to a loss of ambition later in life, and lower political efficacy, so you'll have less faith in your voice in government. So I think that women, when we start talking about this, get it, mm-hmm. because we've all either observed it or experienced it to a greater or lesser extent.
Yeah, I was struck by several of the findings and studies. One was when you talk about habitual body monitoring, this constantly thinking about how do we look, how do I look? It seems to me that I've witnessed myself and every girl or woman within my age range, going all the way back in my memory to middle school, engage in this habitual body monitoring. How do I look in these jeans? How does the swimsuit look? And I was just wondering, did you ever find or come across evidence of girls and women who had just never gotten sucked into this?
Well, there, yes, to the extent that they've thought about it. There are, from my estimate, is about 5% of women who have seriously looked at this and have been able to at least work against it. I would say, not to be too pessimistic, but why not? I've been studying this for 15 years and have been working against it, and I actually find it to be a rather impossible task.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So I think that there are certain people who are on the path to thinking about it. I would argue that, I don't know Britney Spears, but I think that when she shaved her head and started rebelling against, for that short period of time, was rebelling against kind of being the body and rebelling against media, she was reaching a point that I think a lot of women and girls can relate to, where she doesn't want it, and yet how else do we define ourselves in a world that raises us to define ourselves in that sense?
And then I'm just curious, in terms of an international cross-cultural perspective, when looking at this data and these ideas across countries, have researchers seen variations, or does this seem like a worldwide trend?
Well, there are certainly variations, and the general trend is that the more, I'll put this in quotes, advanced a country is in terms of consumerism, the more we see this. So the more images we see of objectified women and girls in a culture, the more we will see women and girls engaging in self-objectification.
I thought it was interesting also your point about the piece around sex and sexuality, and the idea that often when people discuss gender and feminist theory, that they're seen as anti-sex. And one of the things that's so striking about these studies, and even the narrative about this, is this idea that women, when they are engaging in this self-objectification, they are constantly critiquing themselves and their bodies throughout sex. And I think the language one woman used in one of the studies was, it's an out-of-body experience. And there's no focusing on your own sexual pleasure or even what's going on, because you're so busy thinking, how do I look?
Precisely.
Yeah, and it's so ironic that there's always this juxtaposition of, if you're going to talk about feminist ideas, you're somehow anti-sex. And then if we dig under those layers, to really see that deep sexual pleasure and deeply being present within sex is something that's almost impossible within the confines of this kind of objectification. And I don't think that's something that people are really discussing about sex. I mean, there's so many aspects of sex and sexuality that are up for grabs and up for discussion these days as the media has become more tolerant of discussing sex. And it's interesting that there is no conversation about this idea of the freedom to focus on your pleasure when you're constantly getting these messages and the sort of divergent poles between those two things. I'm curious, can you talk a little bit more about the role of mass media in the objectification and self-objectification of girls and women? Obviously there's a key there.
Absolutely. It's the explosion of images, right, of moving from about 500 images per day in the 1970s to about 3,000 images now of women's objectified bodies means that we just have a much more, much greater acceptance. It's more normal or normalized to see women as bodies. And I think that they're, you know, it's generally portrayed as being something that is liberating, and yet I find a women's objectification to be anything but liberating. You know, it's interesting how we talk about, well, we're selling sex. I actually don't think we're selling sex, and the reason that I don't think we're selling sex is that women are sexuate beings as well. And so if we were selling sex, then why wouldn't we see a lot of half-naked men?
Right.
You know, what is it? I mean, marketers are savvy, right? They're going to sell what sells. So if sex really sells, then why isn't sex selling for women? And I would argue that we're selling something else. I think that, you know, in this classic men are subjects who act and women are objects who act upon, which is who are acted upon, which is kind of the standard portrayal of women in movies and television and print advertising, et cetera, on down the line. I really think what we're selling is male subjectivity. I think that we are, what sells about women's objectification is the constant reminder to men that they're on the upper end of that, that they are the subjects, and that they are able and entitled to consume women as objects. So it's power, in a sense. And to that end, I think it's this idea that women showing more skin and somehow being empowered through being an object, which doesn't fundamentally make any sense, you know, is just another myth that women are being sold and some of us are buying into. And it's sad in the sense that it upholds this system, which is very clearly, it just doesn't benefit us.
Mm.
And I would love to see images of, I don't know what sexuality would look like if women owned it, and I don't quite know what that term means, but if it wasn't dictated to us, and if we didn't have male pleasure eroticized as our own pleasure, I don't know what sex acts would look like. I don't know what, you know, what advertising would look like. I don't know what women's sexuality would look like, but I know that it wouldn't look like what's happening now. You know, Jackson Katz is doing this great research where he finds that as a result of the pornification of culture, right, so moving beyond the normalization of women as bodies, as sex objects in the media, we're also mainstreaming porn. And porn is really reduced. It's much more violent than it's ever been. It's kind of like, you know, pro wrestling. If you haven't watched it in 10 years, you'd probably be a bit shocked.
Right?
it's more violent. It's more degrading. And
It's also more entertaining and glamorized.
Porn, absolutely.
Both the wrestling and the porn.
it's not as gritty as it used to be. And it's, as Robert Jensen writes, that, you know, it reduces women now to be crass, you know, to three holes and two hands. And it's so degrading, openly degrading to women, that a lot of this has moved its way into the bedroom. And sex acts for women are moving further away from the clitoris, both literally and figuratively, and away from female pleasure. And so, you know, we're eroticizing sex acts that don't involve our primary sexual organ, which is somewhat absurd. And again, you know, getting back to this idea of what women's sexuality would look like, I don't know, but I do know that women's objectification and our self-objectification really prevents us from exploring those avenues.
Yeah, and some of what you were saying about this sort of pornification and self, how it's merging with the self-objectification, it reminds me of, I know that over the past 5 or 6 years, there have been a lot of exposés, and I use that word in quotes, about the sexuality of youth in the American suburbs and some of the sex parties that young children are having from middle school up, where the focus of the sexual acts is often on acts focused on male pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And so often you have groups of children getting together, engaging in sexual acts and sexuality, and none of it is focused on pleasure for the girls involved. It's all focused on the pleasure of the boys involved. And I think that that is that kind of thread that you see coming out of this level of pornification and self-objectification, where one's very notion of what sex is so artificially shaped by these forces that even your emerging sexuality reflects this self-objectification. Listeners, we're talking about female double consciousness and the article Out of Body Image with the author Dr. Carolyn Heldman. This is Women, Body, and Soul, 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York City, and also streaming live online at www.wbai.org. I'm your host, Natalie Tondiway. I want to just talk a little more about the differences in the experiences of objectification among females and males in our society, because I think sometimes when we look at these analogies, it makes it so clear to us in a way that talking about these kind of clunky academic terms doesn't. You know, I love Professor Mernon's quote, which you shared with us, that girls are taught to view their bodies as projects, whereas, you know, boys learn to view them as tools to master the environment. I was really struck by that quote because I think it really kind of sums it all up, mm-hmm. especially this word projects. It's like that is the message from the moment you sort of emerge into being self-conscious about yourself and your femaleness is that you need work. Mm-hmm. And now that wasn't even a term when I was younger, and now that's a term. I'm getting work done. You know, I think we're consciously seeing ourselves as these projects up for, you know, under construction, constant construction and reconstruction. In order to fit into the dominant mold of what is attractive. And I'm just curious, in some of your research and studies, can you give us other examples of the differences in the dominant messages that boys are getting and girls are getting? You know, I think this does it in some ways, but I just want to make this more clear and more real to people.
Right. Well, one interesting statistic is that the more active little girls are, the less likely they are to drop out of high school, right? The less likely they are to become pregnant as a teenager, and the less likely they are to be victims of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And I think that in drawing this more broadly, it makes a lot of sense when you view your body as moving its way through the world in a sense where you can own or can create or shape the world. And that's the major difference, right? It's the idea that your body is something that you can use to get something else. Mm-hmm. And little girls, in a sense, of course, are using it, and women, to get the holy grail, as I call it, of male attention. Mm-hmm. And the orientation is just, it's night and day. Women, little girls and women, are looking inside and inside to out, meaning that the way in which we feel good about ourselves is external validation. And some men have that as well, increasingly with consumer culture. But by and large, their validation is much more internal. Their confidence is much higher. And this has profound consequences for the distribution of power in American society. And that sounds like an overstatement, but in my other lines of, or related lines of research, I look at women in ambition and leadership and find that by the time women move into the area of their life where they should and could be leaders, they simply don't think in those terms anymore. You know, when we're little boys and little girls, all want to be president, or a vast majority do. Mm-hmm. So ambition starts off pretty equal. But then a decade or two later, we see women, you know, with much lower ambition and confidence. And I think that's perhaps the most concrete manifestation of what we're taught when we're little in terms of viewing ourselves as these projects. Mm-hmm. And one of the really sad things about the project is that it can never be complete, right? The system sets it up so that we're never happy. I have a girlfriend yesterday who is, you know, she's a size zero and is telling me how dissatisfied she is with her body. And it just struck me that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter how close we get to the ideal. We will never accept that proximity. We will never accept that the project is done, because it is never done given the ways in which we're told to think about our bodies.
Mm. And, you know, I'm curious, like, in comparison, you know, what does the interior of the male psyche look like when you compare the area of the brain or the amount of the brain that's used to think about, you know, what do other people think of me? What do they think of my body? I can imagine that it's like a sliver of the amount of energy, if any at all, particularly among heterosexual men. And the idea that women are worrying along, using all this energy this way is really intense. You were about to say?
Well, at the same time as women have been, you know, asked to take up less space, so the average woman you're going to see in media and advertising has shrunk certainly since the 1970s, and we're supposed to focus more on our body as a project, violent masculinity has emerged. And so while men are not spending all of their time in habitual body monitoring, they have new pressures to be big and to have their body be the site of kind of this violent, menacing masculinity. And I'm stating this in very general terms, but yeah, they've got their own headaches. So in that sense, but it, yeah, this is not one of them. But as marketers promote, you know, the idea of metrosexuality, as it's been kind of offensively called, as they promote this idea that men are supposed to spend more time on their bodies, we will see men doing more of that. Although ultimately, their orientation as viewing their bodies as these tools to master the environment means that they will never spend as much time as we do, because they simply don't seek external approval to the same extent.
And it's funny that the quote, the Mernon quote about, you know, boys seeing their bodies as tools to master the environment, it reminds me of an episode of Seinfeld where the group is talking about men's bodies and women's bodies. And I can't remember the analogy they use for women's bodies, but I think one of the characters asks the men, like, well, you know, don't you think of men's bodies this way? And Seinfeld says back, no, no, no. Men are like Jeeps. They're utilitarian, you know? And I think it just, I think that, that it's just so pervasive, that idea, you know, even when we walk down the street and we look at people, both men and women, even our thoughts and how we respond to the sight of women's bodies and the sight of men's bodies affirms this idea of men just sort of moving through the environment in a utilitarian way, and women having all these other values and judgments projected on them, and also that they're projecting on themselves. And also, you know, sometimes when I'm watching, you know, you talked about mass media and this proliferation of images that give us these messages. You know, there's certain, there's one message that I see over and over that I'm always wondering, you know, how do young people interpret this? And it's this now plentiful acting role of the eroticized female homicide victim corpse. And, you know, it's always like a partially or fully nude dead woman. And her body is actually staged in a slightly erotic, suggestive pose. And I can't imagine, you know, if a male body was staged in that way on a primetime show, what the response would be. Yet it's just, as you use the word normalized, that, you know, every night that you turn on the TV, you will see one of these female homicide victim corpses. And I just keep wondering, what is the impact of this kind of imagery on the psyche that is not defending and critiquing and sort of pushing this aside? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it brings up a really important and frightening trend, which is the eroticization of violence, right? So we are mixing our violence and our sex, and who's the audience, right? It's young men, and it's the same. I mean, Jensen finds the same is happening with pornography. So mainstream porn, and then, you know, turning on any television show at 10 or 11 o'clock at night is going to show you these images of, you know, eroticized violence. So what are we doing? I mean, we're hardwiring little boys and men to get turned on by violence against women or violence in general. And I think perhaps the best or most offensive example is a few seasons ago on America's Next Top Model, where they actually had the models pose in death scenes. And they, so one model is posing up against the wall. She's dead, or, you know, supposedly dead, with blood splattered behind her head as though she were shot. You know, another has her internal organs removed, strangulation, all of these things. And it brings up another topic, which the underlying narrative was female competition, right? So the other models were supposed to have murdered each woman in the picture.
Oh, my God.
And so, I mean, that's another one of these, you know, terrible side effects. We're talking about side effects of these trends. And one of them, you know, is female competition and the fact that this holy grail of male attention is seen as finite, as something that if I walk into a room, I'm competing with other women and I'm seeing, you know, where I line up in the pretty girl pecking order. And that's, I think, really, really damaging, and perhaps one of the most depressing parts of it is what it does to female relationships. Mm. And I know that's a different subject than looking at, you know, sexualizing violence, but both of them are pretty negative side effects of all of this.
Listeners, we're talking with author Carolyn Heldman, PhD, author of the article Out of Body Image, appearing in the most recent Ms. Magazine from spring 2008. We're discussing female double consciousness and self-objectification. This is Women, Body, and Soul, 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York City, live online, WBAI.org. I'm your host, Natalie Tandiwe, and we're going to take a brief break.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
FM WBAI New York City, live online at WBAI.org. I'm your host, Natalie Tandiwe, and today our guest is Dr. Carolyn Heldman, author of the article Out of Body Image, Self-Objectification, Seeing Ourselves Through Others' Eyes, How It Impairs Women's Body Image, Mental Health, Motor Skills, and Even Our Sex Lives. Welcome back, Dr. Heldman.
Thank you.
One of the things I wanted to talk about is sometimes, you know, when real men and real women are talking about these ideas around what women think men want, men will say, oh, my God, you guys have it so wrong. That's not what's important. This is also foolish. And I'm just curious, in your review of the literature and, you know, your research and the anecdotes, is the female perception of what men value in women different from what men are reporting that they find valuable or desirable about women?
Well, I think there are maybe two ships passing in the night in terms of what's important. But what I hear women saying in this research and in speaking with mostly with my students is that the systems that we are working with involve, you know, walking by someone on the street or having an interaction with strangers, and that is where we are looking for attention, right? Mm-hmm. We're constantly looking for it when we go into the classroom or into the workplace or, you know, even in our cars, driving on the highway.
Our bubbles.
Exactly. So when we are concerned about this, it's really in our everyday lived experience of just going through the day. But what I hear men saying is that relationships are not built upon that. So when they're in a relationship, when they're interacting with women whom they know and perhaps love, these things are not important. But I think those are two distinct things. One is a relationship and the other is, you know, everyday life. And are men engaging in this and upholding this? Absolutely. I mean, they are raised, we're raised to present the product and they are raised to consume it. So we have this, you know, compulsory female objectification on the part of men. So as much as they say that they don't want this, I have yet to run across any subjects or respondents in my studies or any man I have ever been with who doesn't to some degree engage in this this compulsory consumption of women. And it's not necessarily a conscious thing, but men engage in the consumption. Mm-hmm. They're constantly, you know, looking, some to a greater extent than others. So they are giving us the validation. And in that sense, they are upholding it as they do want the same things in the sense that they're upholding the system that promotes us doing this. Yeah.
And I'm curious, when you talk about the evolution of the shift from objectification to objectification plus self-objectification, you talk about generational differences and how this has evolved over time. And you talk about Gen X and Gen Y, particularly, I guess, Gen Y being one that is deeply involved in the self-objectification. What can you define Gen X and Gen Y and kind of give us these time spans and let us know how they're different from the previous generations and what the distinction is between Gen X and Gen Y regarding this shift from objectification to self-objectification?
Sure. And I should note that I'm a member of Gen X.
Okay.
And it's contested in terms of where the borders are. But in general, Gen Xers are in their 30s and 40s, and Gen Y is in high school and college and approaching 30.
Okay.
So folks who have come of age in the information age would be Gen X, and then folks who've come of age in with Web 2.0, so the you know, these interface technologies like Facebook and MySpace, and now you know the next generation of Second Life, they've come of age with more access to images. Generation Y is the first generation that has been marketed to from cradle to grave. So Gen X, we got a lot of that as teenagers, but Gen Y is actually getting, has direct marketing campaigns to them as children. And they've also been, you know, they've been marketed to in the sense that they have been told that they are the center of the universe. So Jeannie Twenge, who's written the book Generation Me, talks about some of those negative effects, which are somewhat dovetail with my research, and that the ways in which we interact with other people and grow up in the world is very much shaped by our media culture. So not only does this generation have more access, Generation Y have more access to images, they also have more of a sense that this is the way the world is, and they're much more disconnected from previous generations. You know, when I was in grade school, I used to love listening to the rock and roll of my older siblings, and had that connection. And now that pop culture connection has been severed. So essentially, you know, Generation Y is kind of floating in its own in its own media world, and that media world provides images of women as sex objects, and perhaps more importantly, as sex objects who are empowered through that, which is, of course, a lie. It's a myth. But this is all they know. So that's kind of a long intro in terms of saying there isn't the intergenerational dialogue that can help give young women media literacy to understand that that they're not going to get power through being sex objects. It's just not the way the world works. They'll get power through being subjects. And so we have young women, for example, who are now headed out into the workforce, and they think that plunging necklines are going to get them power.
I've noticed,
right. All this business literature coming out now saying that women who dress provocatively or dress sexy in the workplace don't get promoted as quickly. They're not given the same level of respect. So it's having real-world ramifications now with young women moving into the workforce.
And I'm curious, you know, when you talk about this trend of girls and women celebrating their objectification, and this seeming sense of empowerment, where is this confusion? Why are they so confused? I'm not sure what the source of the confusion is and why it's not evident where one really gets power from.
That's a great question, and one I've explored to some extent. I think the answer is that women in media are increasingly portrayed as getting power through their bodies. So we have this emergence of this new kind of archetype in movies that we haven't seen before. And it's this idea of a very physically empowered woman who, even though she appears to be, you know, very have her own agency and be very strong and empowered, ultimately she's very sexualized, highly sexualized. So her existence is really for the male gaze, right? So ultimately, she still exists for men. Yet the message being sent is that she's empowered. So, and how is she empowered? She's empowered through, you know, not only kicking butt like the boys, but she's also empowered by getting male attention. So we see, you know, Lara Croft, Tomb Raider. We see Elektra. I'm trying to think of some more recent examples. Kill Bill's a little more complicated, but we see some of that there. Mm-hmm. So we see this emergence of this archetype, and I think that this is a theme in a lot of media targeted at young people, especially young women, that they can get power by getting male attention, and that's really what matters in this world. So I think media is the culprit here.
And I'm curious, was there a shift, or was there just a vacuum before? I mean, before, do you think there were other examples of how women could create power in their lives? And then there was this shift to this objectification of power, or was there just a vacuum, and in the vacuum we were creating our own notions?
Well, I've studied cinema for the past mm-hmm. 50 years approximately, and have reached the conclusion that there's never been a moment in time, an extended period of time, where women are given real, round characters that promote some sort of empowerment or reality or you know, humanity, if you will, in theater. But I think it's worse now than it has ever been. I would say that perhaps the apex, that the height of this was Thelma and Louise, which when it hit the theaters, you know, love it or hate it, it's a complicated movie as well. Thelma and Louise really pushed the boundaries in terms of the fact that the two female characters are the protagonists throughout. They, while there's some sexualization, they appear to be in control of it instead of existing for the male gaze. And they're violent. They're really challenging these notions of quote-unquote proper femininity, which are so threatening. Kill
Don't
Bill.
They drive off a cliff in the end?
And they do, right? I mean, ultimately,
okay.
that's you know, one of the critiques is that, okay, you challenged, ultimately, when you challenge it like that, it can't happen.
It can't go on.
Right, so the narrative has to be that you die. And I see that, yeah, certainly very symbolic. And then we have Kill Bill, right, more recently, a lot more sexualization, but doing some of the same work, but really amplified female objectification. And I think that those two examples show you what's happened in the past, you know, 10-15 years, that we just couldn't have Thelma and Louise now without having them show their midriffs, and that's an important shift.
Yeah, and I'm curious, can you think of examples in cinema of positive examples of female empowerment that aren't involving this objectification and this male gaze?
Well, Natalie, you know, I study media, which simply means I get to go to the movies a lot and feel like
I'm
doing
honest.
Work. Yeah, love it. I love media. I love watching it and consuming it. And I would say that I don't have one clear example in mainstream media of this kind of unequivocal promotion of what I feel to be women's empowerment. I think that Mean Girls tried to do that, but
That's
I think ultimately...
That's a very consumerist movie, though.
Oh, it failed miserably,
yeah.
And I would say it failed miserably in the sense that the whole idea was to kind of challenge the myth of prettiness, that, you know, being pretty and the importance of that. But ultimately what happens at the end, instead of saying, look, we don't need the holy grail of male attention, that shouldn't be the end-all be-all of our existence, instead we see the protagonist breaking up a crown, right, a crown that she has been given because she is the prettiest, and distributing it to all the women so symbolically, right, that don't worry, we can all get male attention, and
right.
that will be okay. And so I'm looking at the movie in the theater thinking, wow, it fails.
Yeah.
And then we see, you know, more recently this summer, for example, I think that Iron Man, one of my favorite movies, but wow, is it flawed?
Yeah.
It's flawed in terms of, well...
That character could have been written in 1932, his secretary.
your time was going to say the lead.
Oh, both of them, but particularly Gwyneth Paltrow's character. It seemed like they just lifted the template from some 30s and 40s movies and just kind of stuck her in there.
Yep, Pepper's character is very reminiscent of that, right? So she's conventional, and he's conventional, and I think that some of the other characters, what's new, right, is that they present career women. So Pepper is kind of a career woman, but they're tempering her, you're right, with this kind of nostalgic notion of the properly feminine woman.
And she's the ultimate assistant. She's a Gal Friday.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think the fact that they didn't, well, for anyone who hasn't seen it, we're ruining the movie,
but the fact that they don't end up getting together
is a nice kind of twist. But his female characters, I think he tries to present them, the director tries to present them as being career women, yet he instantly diminishes them to objects by having the protagonist sleep with them. So he shows these kind of strident, strong career women who are then put in their place by, you know, through sexual pursuits. So it's a really sad time, I think. It's worse now than it was a decade ago in terms of trying to present these roles where women are empowered and are doing something rather than just being, you know, sex objects or sex kittens, but failing miserably and perhaps being even more offensive in starting off
failure.
A good place.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, and then it's interesting that notion of, okay, if you encounter a very powerful female character, then the thing to do to regain your footing or your hand is to sleep with her, i.e. conquer her sexually.
Absolutely.
And so that message, I mean, I can only imagine how that filters down through the consciousness if you're not, you know, critiquing and defending against mass media. Listeners, we're talking about female double consciousness and self-objectification with Dr. Carolyn Heldman, author of Out of Body Image, appearing in the latest edition of Ms. Magazine. You talk about the rise of a consumer-based value system and the decline of what's known as the producer citizen as one of the root causes in this normalization of female self-objectification, at least here in this country. And can you explain these two value systems and the process of their shift and how it's impacted objectification?
Sure. It's the idea of consumerism, or the consumer citizen, replacing this concept of the producer citizen, I think is epitomized with a quote, a JFK quote, where he, you know, asked the American public, ask not what you can do, what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And that's really the producer citizen, the citizen who used to be connected to their neighbors, used to participate in politics, and used to have much more of a community orientation and a producer orientation in terms of wanting to be engaged in government or be engaged in your community. And that's really been supplanted and replaced, I would say almost completely replaced with the consumer citizen. Mm-hmm. And again, some people are still participating to a greater or lesser extent in their community, but by and large, your average citizen today is not asking what they can do for their government. They're asking what their government can do for them and what everybody else can do for them. So it's this very kind of inner-directed, some might say more self-centered orientation. And this has actually led to a great decline in people turning out to vote, mm-hmm. in people who care about their neighborhoods, people who are active at the local, state, and federal level. And it's also, you know, had an impact on relationships because we view ourselves as constantly being on the in an exchange, and we are on the receiving end. So I haven't seen good research on this, but my guess is that higher divorce rates are somewhat tied into this. You know, not that higher divorce rates are necessarily a negative in terms of gender, but I would say that the breakdown in interpersonal relationships as well as political activism are all linked to this, that, you know, we go through our daily existence and we're very entitled consumers. Mm-hmm. And this has really come about because we have let marketers into our lives in very big ways, and we spend a lot
bedrooms.
More time. Indeed. Indeed.
Going back to your invocation of W.E.B. Du Bois's double consciousness paradigm, you know, when we look at female self-objectification, we also have to consider race and culture and class. And within any system of objectification, there's always this assumption about what is desirable, what is beautiful, what is not. And in U.S. culture, the assumed standard of beauty for women is based on white, Western, European kind of bourgeoisie ideals, slenderness, narrow features and bone structure, long straight hair, light skin, light coloring. And, you know, we kind of see variations on this core template when we see the, quote, desirable female depicted in media, or when we see what's agreed upon in the mass mind as attractive. And for women of color and other women who don't fulfill what you might say enough of these standards for there to be a tipping point where, you know, you'd get the attractive stamp of approval, objectification and self-objectification take on a whole other dimension because there's this piece of, you know, innately never being a part of the dominant beauty standard. And I'm curious, what does the discourse and the research on self-objectification, what is it finding about women of color and women who don't fit into the dominant U.S. beauty standards?
Well, my own research finds that self-objectification exists in pretty sizable levels for all women. However, one of the benefits of being a woman of color is that the further, in terms of self-objectification, is that the further you get away from white standards of beauty, the less you self-objectify. So in terms of rankings, white women are self-objectifying at the highest rates, which makes sense when you look at the system of, white supremacy that works its way into, as you had commented, what's acceptable, what is considered the norm and the beauty ideal. So the more, the closer you are to that in terms of race, the higher you self-objectify. Then comes Latinas. So Latinas self-objectify on average the second highest. And women of different Asian nationalities and ethnicities objectify less than Latinas and white women, and black women self-objectify the least. Mm. Again, high rates in all groups, but the differences are significant, which really tells us something about self-objectification.
Well, and I also have to wonder, as a woman of color, I mean, I think it also depends on how you measure self-objectification. You know, often when I read studies about ideas around objectification or, you know, eating disorders and things like that, they'll say, oh, well, you know, white women are the ones most consumed with this. And, you know, women of color are further and further away, with black women being the furthest away. But then when I look at the yardsticks that they use to measure what's going on, I say to myself, well, as a woman of color, I can tell you that's not a meaningful yardstick. Mm-hmm. So I always wonder, you know, I'm not familiar firsthand with the discourse and the research, but when I look at video culture, and I look at young black women's response to it and how many of them have gotten sucked into it if they don't have, you know, a critical, you know, media literacy in their lives from their families or, you know, this critical thinking. I feel like I'm seeing a lot of self-objectifying within the community. So, you know, I would be curious to see what are these yardsticks and are there other measures that might be more meaningful for women of color in looking at this kind of research?
I would very much agree with you, Natalie, that in analyzing rap and hip-hop videos, the video hoe is the norm, right? I mean, that image has emerged and is, Nelly's tip drill video, for example, is perhaps the low point of those images. One interesting phenomenon that I've discovered in doing research on rap and hip-hop is that the black women whom I've interviewed pretty resoundingly say that even though they're consuming those images, they don't think that represents them. And so there is this kind of, and maybe it's naive, obviously it's somewhat naive, right, that somehow doesn't represent you. Of course it does. In the sense that media images do end up representing and telling stories about the norm. But in terms of measuring self-objectification, mm-hmm. one of the nice things about the measure is that it's a self-reported measure, mm-hmm. and it focuses on how much time you spend basically thinking of your body as a tool to master the environment, if you will, or right. how much time you spend thinking about your body in terms of positive things such as, you know, muscle mass or ability versus viewing your body in terms of your hair color and being skinny and pleasing. So it's a self-report measure, which means that women get to, the women who take the survey and do the 12-point scale are reporting on focusing on their various features, but it doesn't require your features to be similar or to even to be the white norm.
Mm-hmm. I think I see the measure in the back of one of the studies. I'm going to take a look at it. I only read the text of the study but didn't read the measure, but I'll definitely take a look at it with all those things in mind. And we're actually at the end of our time together. I want to thank you for joining us on Women, Body, and Soul for our discussion of out-of-body image, about female double consciousness and self-objectification with Dr. Carolyn Heldman. Dr. Heldman, can you share your website with the audience?
Sure. Actually, I'd like to share two websites.
Okay, go ahead.
If I can. I'm also the director of the Women's Shelter in New Orleans, and the best way to reach that is www.nolawomensshelter.org.
Mm-hmm.
And also www.oxy.edu. I'm teaching at Barack Obama's, a school he attended for 2 years, so I'll give him a plug.
Okay. This is Women, Body, and Soul, 99.5 FM, WBAI, Pacifica Radio, New York. I'm your host, Natalie Tondiway. Listener comments and feedback can be emailed to me at wbsradio@mail.com. W like women, B like body, S like soul, wbsradio@mail.com. Thank you, listeners. We know it's your support making BAI Pacifica Radio possible, and we love you. Have a great day.
I'm keeping my eyes on you. I bet you think I don't know nothing but singing the blues. Oh, sister, have I got news for you? I'm something. I hope you think that you're something too. So shake your shimmy, sister, 'cause honey, the sugar is feeling
fine. And you are tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM on the web at WBAI.org. The longest walk made history 30 years ago. Help make history again. Sponsor a member of the Indian community or Katrina Rita, hurricane survivor, to join the longest walk. For information about this event, I have a number for you. You can call Charles at 347-760-7353. That's Charles at 347-760-7353 for information on the longest walk to justice for Katrina and Rita survivors. And the previous program, Women, Body, and Soul, let's give that website out again, wbsradio.com, wbsradio.com, Women, Body, and Soul. And the other website, the NOLAWomensShelter.org. Let's give that out once again. The NOLAWomensShelter.org. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station WBAI at 99.5 FM. And remember, the website is always available and is a really terrific way to make credit card donations outside of our fundraising drives, our major fundraising drives that we have here at WBAI. So if you'd like to support the Women, Body, and Soul, you can log on to that website right now and make a contribution, or for the upcoming program, The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille. It's 1 p.m. in New York City. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind.